William is quiet beside her, but she can feel his tension. Finally, he lifts her by the elbow and says,
"We need to leave here, now."
"But my brothers," he chokes out. "They were traveling with a large retinue to overlook stores of Arbinian weapons proffered to the Delusian Council."
"And they were ambushed?"
"At Tristis Pass, not far from here. Come on, we have nothing to stay for anyhow." His voice is urgent. "No one is by. We can slip away unnoticed if we hurry."
Her pulse hammers in her ears. William's right. For all they know, his brother's killers could still be lurking nearby, protected by locals and perhaps even by the convent itself. They have to leave now and quickly. But even as they flee the courtyard in broad daylight and head for the road into the nearest village, the foolish part of Isby, her curiosity, thinks they ought to have stayed to learn more. She can hardly imagine Hildegard harboring murderers. Still, she feels William's wariness as they make their way toward town. And it begins to infect her as well, starting out as a tension in her hands and wrists, evolving into a stiffness in her chest. As they enter the village in search of horses to take them the rest of the way, they find it eerily quiet. Even in winter, there should be peasants herding goats to market, traders hawking wares, people going about their daily business with a coarse and noisy obliviousness. Instead, the tension, Isby realizes, is not just within her, but outside of her too, in the lack of busy voices and grunts and...
"Where is everyone?"
she whispers to William. She clutches the Arbinian dagger, which she has shoved into her belt, hiding the seal beneath a fold of her dress.
"Something isn't right."
No sooner are the words out of her mouth than a man's deep voice barks out,
"Halt, in the name of Queen Malfleur!"
Isby always thought that her death would have some sort of meaning or bravery to it. Maybe she'd have a dramatic fall from a wild horse. Maybe she'd throw herself before a drawn rapier at some profound and important moment. Maybe she'd lose her mind and run naked through a frozen field, hollering until her last breath turned to frost. But now, she fears her death will be swift and unremarkable. There's no doubt the soldiers intend to kill her and the prince. She and William are currently sitting back to back on the floor of a recently abandoned manor, tied together by the wrists. The lord who once governed over the village from this very manor is still where the soldiers left him, hanging, dead and bloodied, from the front gates of his own estate, winter flies ravenous at his eye sockets. Isby didn't even need William's gruesome, whispered description to envision it. She got all the information she required from the stench as they were shoved past, before being dragged roughly inside, thrown to the floor and bound. The soldiers, who apprehended them, are just beyond a closed door, arguing in gruff murmurs. Perhaps it is stubbornness alone that's keeping her from succumbing to complete panic. That and the lingering question blazing through her brain like fire. How did the soldiers discover their identities? It's not like the visages of Deleuze's bastard half-princess or even Arbin's youngest, and thus, until recently, least important prince are well known across the land. Neither of their faces has made it onto any stamps or coins. The mercenaries did find the dagger Isby was carrying, bearing the royal insignia, but that alone would not be proof of anything. Perhaps they make an unusual pair, William with his noble bearing and the smooth dark skin of a high-born Arbinian, and Isby with her sightless eyes and raggedly shorn locks. But the soldiers didn't just capture them because they're unusual. They specifically referred to Isby and William as the ones we've been looking for. Isby can hear their muffled argument through the door, even now. One word emerges from the rest, ringing out like the toll of a bell.
Ransom.
William's body goes alert against hers. He has heard it too. Which is perhaps why neither of them is all that shocked when, a short while later, a couple of the soldiers burst back into the room and, instead of threatening them with violence, simply corral them toward a covered wagon. By now it is getting late, and Isby can feel the chill as the winter sun begins to sink below the horizon. She's heaved up onto the back of the wagon and hears the swish of leather and clanking of metal rings as a horse is harnessed. So, she will not be making her journey to the afterlife today. She will be making the journey instead to Lamort, presumably to become a pawn in the Fairy Queen's game. She thinks of the models William carved, the miniature knights, the ships, and the cannon, how they reminded her of elaborate chess pieces. For some reason, even though she should be thinking about ways to escape, or to die nobly if they're tortured for information, she instead thinks how wondrous it must feel to turn an unyielding mass of ivory or marble into an object that seems to breathe. So different from one of her silly snow statues, she thinks uncontrollably and irrationally of William's hands. A bell peals in the distance, probably all the way from the convent, signaling evening vespers once again. The nuns will be going about their divine offices, pews lined with their devout postures and solemn faces, the prioress probably wondering, meanwhile, where her new visitors have gone.
"Isabel," William whispers now.
It's the first thing he's dared to utter since their capture, and her name itself sounds forbidden to her. Foreign. Isabel is a stranger, a woman being held hostage in a war that's only just beginning. Her role in it uncertain and out of her hands. Isby is not that woman.
"Isabel,"
he repeats more urgently.
"If we're parted, or if I don't get another chance to tell you this..."
He wraps his hand around hers and squeezes it. She feels a small, unexpected shock, like a piece of flint sparking in her chest. A wish, maybe. But nothing ever comes of wishing, Isby reminds herself. He doesn't get to finish his sentence. Instead, there is a loud swishing rush of wind, like a flock of enormous birds converging nearby. Isby and William, simultaneously tense. There's a startled cry of one soldier, followed quickly by a gargling gasp, as though his partner is choking on his own spit. Then a few swift swipes of fabric through the air, the thump of a skull coming into contact with a rock and two thuds. There's a breathy voice, unpeeling the dark, like a snake shedding its skin.
"Hurry up, before the rest of them come out!"
Isby knows that voice. It's Sister Genevieve. Isby shuffles along the dirt road that leads out of the village, under the hasty cover of the spare habit Sister Genevieve gave her. William, too, is wearing one. Under different circumstances, the disguise might be comical. As it is, the reality of the situation has begun to sink in. They were nearly killed, nearly shipped off as bait in a larger conflict. She hadn't been afraid, hadn't allowed herself to be, but now her body won't stop shaking.
"Where are you leading us?" William asked.
Sister Genevieve and Sister Catherine are guiding them rapidly through the darkened countryside.
"Somewhere it's a bit more fit than where we found you,"
Sister Catherine replies. Isby's mind is reeling.
But why? How? When?
She doesn't even know where to begin. The shock of being rescued by the nuns has yet to fade.
"What did you do to the soldiers?"
"Knocked out. But they'll be coming too shortly,"
Sister Catherine explains, a note of pride in her voice. William is obviously just as baffled as Isby is.
"Those men were twice your size."
"She keeps us in good shape, Mother Hild."
"Sister Catherine,"
Genevieve whispers. Sister Catherine huffs.
"You were the one who insisted on rescuing them. Said it weren't fair to sell them off like a pound of lamb's meat at market."
"Sell us off?"
William asks. Isby hears a knife's edge in his voice. She's feeling something similar, too, down in her gut, like she's been stabbed. Sister Genevieve sighs.
"I suppose you may as well know the truth. The prioress felt we could garner much-needed funds by offering you two up to the enemy. And she was right. We did get a healthy sum."
The invisible knife in Isby's gut twists. Mother Hildegard gave them away.
"But how did she know who we are?"
Sister Genevieve snorts.
"We had our suspicions from the start. Catching you snooping around in the scriptorium didn't help. But it was really Hildegard herself who recognized you, Isabel. Said you got the same look as your mother,"
Sister Catherine adds. Isby gasps, a strangled sound.
"She knew my mother. What did she say?"
"Only that much and nothing more," says Catherine. "No need to slow down. We still got a long way to go and back before morning, lords, or we'll be missed,"
Sister Genevieve says, pulling Isby along by the elbow.
"So the prioress has been what? Training you to defend yourselves against soldiers?"
William says, something like stunned amusement in his voice.
"Among other things," says Catherine. And then it occurs to Isby. "Last night, the granary, you weren't checking for vermin at all, were you?"
Sister Genevieve answers.
"We were practicing. Every night a group of us stays awake, learning our stances, exercising our skills, handling new weapons. Granary's the perfect spot, big enough, empty enough, and the thick walls hide any sound."
It all begins to unfold in Isby's mind.
You keep the weapons buried in the graveyard during the day.
There's a silence.
Yes, Catherine answers, clearly impressed that she has pieced it together. Can't risk anyone discovering we're in possession of stolen royal weapons.
Stolen? Isby feels a flood of victory. She was right about one thing. The convent was not harboring or protecting William's brother's murderers. They were hiding the weapons and the weapons only. And Hildegard may have betrayed them, but it was in the interest of supporting a convent full of orphan girls, educating them about the world, and training them to be able to protect themselves in the event of war. The surprise of it is quickly replaced by awe. Isby would rather be betrayed 1,000 times by such a woman than allied to one less brave and interesting.
We're almost there now, Catherine says.
Why are you helping us? Isby asks quietly.
Because, Sister Genevieve says, if you really are who Mother Hildegard says you are, and you plan to seal an alliance between Arbin and Deluce against Malfleur, then we might consider you two our only hope.
Sister Catherine murmurs in agreement. Only thing more evil than the Fairy Queen of Lamore is her dead sister. Nothing was ever as bad as the Night Fairy, of course.
Sister Genevieve ignores her comment.
But you two will have to somehow survive the sickness and the mounting presence of Lamort's soldiers. It's said they're immune to it. Those beaks they wear protect them somehow, which means, for all we know, they've already got plans to seize the palace. Time is of the essence. You'll never do it without help.
And so you're leading us to, William begins.
The Veiled Road, of course, Catherine answers.
Veiled Road? Isby asks. It's a safe route through the kingdom, Genevieve explains.
Mostly servants in noble houses and the like, Sister Catherine adds, willing to help each other out in the case of a military takeover.
Isby marvels and thrills at the idea of the Veiled Road, delighting to imagine the council's shock if they were to find out how organized some parts of the serfdom really are. At the same time, this information is only further proof of what William told her back in Arbin, that Deluce's aristocracy is famous for not understanding the lives and needs of its own peasants. It's something that really needs to change if Deluce is ever to become the kind of nation that can truly defend itself and respond to the needs of the people. A kingdom divided is a kingdom doomed. That much is obvious. Certainly, it is obvious to Malfleur.
Isby's heart rate picks up again as she reminds herself of the urgency of her journey. She needs to awaken Aurora, undoing the curse and giving a sign to Malfleur that her country is not as weak as it seems. But then what? Then they will have to defend themselves, with the help of William's armies. They will have to fight.
27. Malfleur, the Last Fairy Queen. Mountain folk hold a very different view of hunting than plains folk do. Though she resisted at first, the queen has come to learn the nature of the Lamort people over time, and even to admire their savage, survivalist ways. Still, she hadn't realized how much she missed the more civilized hunting rituals she grew up with. The rhythmic mass of horses moving in unison across wide fields, and then the blur of mottled leaves as they cantered through the royal forest. The hounds' zealous barks echoing under the metallic arc of dawn. The rapid pounding of hooves reverberating through her entire being until she felt herself to be both an intrinsic part of the living landscape and its master, its god. The queen digs her heels into her stallion's side and leans forward, savoring the wind in her hair as she races across the greenest valley in the territories. It has been a long time since she has been out on a hunt like this. For a moment, she can almost forget that her kingdom is on the brink of war, a war of her own creation. She hears her cousin Almandine catching up to her now as they head back to the castle empty-handed.
Did you invite me out here after all these years simply to show off your superior riding form?
Her cousin asks with a smirk. Her courser's hooves splash across wet mud.
Or to gauge the likelihood of my support for your campaign?
Neither, Malfleur thinks as she takes in Almandine's impeccable posture, her body almost an extension of the animal's. She's tall for a woman, tall for a fairy too, and unlike most of their other remaining relatives, she has kept up her appearance over the last century, though her hair always has the look of someone who has only recently gotten out of bed. Yes, Almandine remains one of the prettiest and most self-possessed of the lesser nobility.
If Melfleur were to desire the company of other fae, she might in fact choose Almandine over the likes of Claudine or Binks or that blithering Violet.
"Aren't I allowed a visit every once in a while, for nostalgia's sake?" the Queen asks.
Almandine shrugs, trotting ahead. Perhaps she even believes Malfleur. After all, a joy in the sports of hunting and hawking was, in fact, one of the few things Malfleur and Almandine used to have in common when they were much younger, though for different reasons. While Malfleur took pleasure in the art of the chase, Almandine was drawn to the athleticism of riding, and the ample opportunities a hunting party afforded for drinking and flirtation, of course. But this morning, Malfleur didn't have any real intention of capturing prey, at least not the type to be caught with a bow and arrow. She has her eye on a far more elusive prize. She and Almandine approach Blackthorn, their entourage trailing behind. From this angle, it rises up before them, regal and full of old-fashioned elegance, unlike the palace in Deleuze. Once her childhood home, the Deleuzian palace now bears almost no resemblance to what it looked like then. King Henri, along with a string of mortal monarchs that came before him over the past 100 or so years, made continual updates to the architecture and interior. Paintings that once depicted the fairy histories were replaced with giant portraits of human kinds, with their thick beards and rolling stomachs, until the place began to reek of excess and bombast. You'd never know that a couple of little fairy twins, Malfleur and Belle Coeur, used to run through those very halls, laughing and carving notes to each other in the walls. You'd never know there used to be dozens of hidden passages connecting various rooms to form a sort of secret maze throughout the castle. Now, as far as Malfleur knows, their entrances have all been filled in with cheap plaster. But ever since Malfleur assumed control of the La Morte territories all those years ago, she has taken great pains to keep Blackthorn's original beauty intact.
"I never knew you were the sentimental type," Almandine comments, one eyebrow arched smartly as they enter the main hall, where an array of her favourite treats, including distilled mulberry gin, have been laid out. "You really haven't changed this place a bit, even after all these years."
She turns to the Queen, her amethyst eyes sparkling like the crystal cordial glasses on the tray.
"You remember the very first time we were here together, don't you?"
She gives a double clap.
"What a party that was."
Melfleur removes her riding gloves slowly, remembering. A great number of fairy families had been invited up to Blackthorn during the height of hunting season. Back then the fae and the human nobility were much chummier than they are today. She and Belle Coeur had come along, though since they were only 13 years old at the time, their mother tried to forbid them from socializing in the evenings. Of course, Malfleur had never been one to obey rules.
"As I recall," she says now, filling Almandine's glass with a generous pour, "you gambled away all of your clothing in a particularly naughty game of whist."
Almandine has always been known for her promiscuity.
She has even converted her home to mimic a Roman bathhouse, though it's hardly an improvement over a common brothel.
"And you, in typical fashion, managed to give up only a single pearl from your necklace," Almandine recounts. "You always were a coy one."
Now Malfleur returns her smile. She remembers they'd established the rules of their little game. For every trick taken, the player could demand that any other player in the game remove one article of his or her attire. Many of the young men, more seasoned at card games than the women, had focused their attentions on Almandine from the start, who found herself half naked by the third round, precisely because she inevitably chose materialism over modesty, far more willing to give up her fur-collared cape and gown than her jewels. Malfleur remembers staring in shock at her older cousin, who sat on the arm of a chair, just a lacy chemise slipping off one shoulder, an emerald ring the size of a ram's eye on her thumb knuckle, and her delicate wrist piled high with glinting bracelets as she twisted her hair and laughed with an easy open mouth. But when the dashing 15-year-old Charles Blackthorn won a hand, he turned instead to Malfleur. She reached up to touch her necklace, the only accessory she wore, then hesitated. The necklace, in fact, belonged to her mother. She'd stolen it before sneaking out of the guest quarters that night. She'd be in terrible trouble if her mother found it missing. Still, her pride prevented her from undoing even a button from her gown. And so, she cleverly unthreaded the necklace, removed a single pearl from its string, and handed the pearl to him. The other men in the game laughed at her stunt and pounded Charles on the back, wishing him better luck next time. Later that night, Charles spotted her as she was sneaking back to the rooms where her sister and parents lay sleeping. He stopped her in the dim-lit hall and took the pearl from his pocket, offering it to her between his fingers.
"I would hate for your necklace to remain incomplete."
She stared up at him and replied, "The night would be incomplete if you don't keep it. It would mean I had not played fair, had not kept my word." Charles grinned.
"I admire a girl who keeps her word."
The way he gazed at her, it was as though he didn't even see the puckered white scar that streaked across her left eyelid, part of her brow and upper cheek, a burn that hadn't healed and never would. "So keep the pearl as a reminder that I am that kind of girl." He took a step closer and leaned down to her height.
"I will keep it then."
He held the pearl to his lips and kissed it, which sent a shiver down the young Malfleur's spine, before he replaced it safely in his chest pocket.
"You have my word," he said.
It hadn't been until almost a year later, when they were summering at their family's cottage, that Malfleur's mother finally noticed there was something wrong with the necklace and called Malfleur to her angrily, demanding to know what she'd done. She grabbed her daughter's wrist hard and made her watch as she threw the necklace into the blazing hearth, stating that it had been irreparably ruined by her whorish, thieving paws. Malfleur began to defend herself, fury and humiliation causing the magic in her veins to boil when Belcur appeared and took the blame, claiming she had borrowed the necklace to try it on and that she had snagged it, clumsily, when she'd gone out to pluck roses from the garden. Belcur was always doing things like that, emerging angelically at just the right time to stand up for her twin. Back then, her sister's sweetness had frustrated Malfleur, as though Belcur was purposefully reminding everyone that she was the kinder, better, more beautiful one. It was only later that Malfleur began to suspect her sister's intentions weren't so innocent, began to realize that Belcur was like a shadow, always just to Malfleur's side, smiling benignly, waiting to inherit the light as soon as her sister left it. After all, no one could ever compete with Malfleur's magic, or challenge it, except for Belcur. Almandine has travelled with a retinue of her favourite servants, and as she tips back her third glass of mulberry gin, one of them is rubbing her bare feet with oil, a tall, golden-skinned man with shoulder muscles that bulge through his livery. She moans softly, her eyelids half-lowered. "My dear," Malfleur says, hiding her disgust. The memories have given her an unexpected pain in her stomach. "Have another glass." Almandine grins drowsily and accepts. "Tell me." The Queen sits back down in her clawfoot chair and stares at her cousin. "Have you ever considered a different tithe?" She keeps her voice casual. Almandine's heavy eyelids flutter open slowly.
Whatever do you mean?"
"Never mind," Malfleur answers quickly. She expected her cousin's confusion. Fairy tithing is quite simple. It's an unspoken bargain between two people, a willingness, a desire. In Almandine's case, it's a sense of touch. In Malfleur's, it's youth, beauty, time. Tithes rarely change because the Fae don't change. Their core desires remain the same forever, defining who they are. Or so Malfleur thought, until she began her experiments. Almandine shakes her head.
"You're an odd one, my dear. I've never doubted that, you and your puzzles." She instructs the servant to massage her neck next. "Speaking of puzzles, I do wonder how you really intend to take over the Delusian throne when the kingdom is ravaged by this sleeping sickness." "Do you know anything about it?" Malfleur can't tell whether Almandine is testing her. After all, her cousin goes on, how will your own troops survive? Isn't it interesting how a curse has come both to devastate the palace and protect it?
Now the queen is certain. She's definitely goading her. But Malfleur isn't easily ruffled. That simple, sweetheart. I figured out how to create a resistance to the sickness. The same way anyone would, by first understanding the curse.
Almandine once again looks baffled and a little curious.
Do share.
Malfleur retrieves a set of wrapped sketches drawn up by her Minister of War and begins unrolling them on the table beside her cousin. She watches in satisfaction as Almandine gapes at the black, beak-like masks she has devised for her soldiers.
Almandine shivers. I confess I don't understand, she hesitates. But I see why everyone believes what they believe about you.
Which is, Almandine looks at her and murmurs,
that you are evil.
Is that so? Malfleur keeps her tone neutral.
I suppose we'll see about that, won't we?
She can tell by the way Almandine stiffens that she has succeeded in unnerving her. Wait here. She pushes out of her chair and makes her way to the dressing chamber in the East Hall. She tilts the mirror toward her, its surface dinged and scratched from the panther's attempts to attack its own reflection. Malfleur smooths her riding dress and then touches her face, which, thanks to her tithe, is almost as youthful as it had been when she was only 13, when she first met Charles Blackthorne. Despite the mottled scar across one eye, the one she's known for, the one she'd had since early childhood. And yet, an entirely different person looks back at her. Gone is the innocence that once brightened her eyes. Now they are dark and hard like polished onyx. She takes in a slow breath. She can't believe Almandine thinks she actually invited her here to gain her support. No, Almandine, like nearly all of her kind, has proved herself worthless over the past century. The once glorious race of the Fae has burned down to just a few glowing embers. But if today goes as planned, it will be the beginning of a whole new era. It'll mean she's on the brink of a greater power than any fairy in the history of the known world has ever possessed. For the Fae have only ever tithed from humans. In that way, they've always depended on the race that has been slowly, for many centuries, displacing them. But Malfleur has been practicing, learning to tithe more than just youth and beauty. And now, she hopes she has mastered the greatest feat ever. Tithing magic. She has failed before, aims too high. Sometimes when she closes her eyes at night, Malfleur still sees the red throne and the blood of the North Fairy staining her hands. That had been an accident. The goal was never to kill the other fairies, not exactly. Only to take what was most important to them. After she succeeds with Almandine, there'll be no stopping her. Soon, no one will be able to match her power. Not even Belcur. 28. Isabel.
Isby used to enjoy teasing her sister for her notions about love and marriage and, of course, the princes of Arben. She always thought romance was a cloudy concept, like the steam over a pot of boiling stew. It smells of hearty ingredients. It warms the senses. But ultimately, it dissolves. It won't satisfy you and certainly won't keep you alive. The soup of life is something else. It's the things you do to build up who you are. Exploration of the world and of your own mind. The important thing, then, is the soup. But like steam, romantic love in and of itself has no survivalist function. It's just the excuse rich people use so they can marry and procreate and continue their lineages, so they can go on perpetuating the belief that their families deserve to live in giant, fully staffed palaces while every other family is forced to cling to any crust of bread they can get their hands on. There are many things Isby used to believe, but similes elude her now. All she can fathom currently is the proximity of Prince William's very literal, semi-unclothed body. Which is, now that she thinks about it,
coated in completely non-metaphorical steam. That's because they happened to be hiding out in a stone-walled sauna, deep in the cellars of the fairy Almondine's estate, where a servant insisted they'd be least likely to be discovered. They're sitting on benches on opposite walls facing each other, and William's doublet is currently lying discarded somewhere. They were told nearly an hour ago to wait here for Annette, the head housemaid, who was supposed to come for them and show them to a safe room to sleep for the day, before commencing their travels. "Perhaps we could at least remove a few of the rocks," Isby mutters now. The sauna is heated with hot stones from a fire that are then dunked in water, creating the steam that heats up the enclosed space. She's glad for once that she chopped off her hair. At least she doesn't have to feel it sticking wetly to her skin. Then again, the shorter locks make her feel more vulnerable too, more exposed.
"You heard what they said," William replies. The mistress of the house likes everything maintained, apparently. She'd notice if the servants didn't keep the sauna heated throughout the day and night. "Still, I suppose it's a bit unfair for you."
"Why for me?"
"Well, I don't need to worry about modesty. I could be sitting here naked and you'd never know."
There's a bit of laughter in his tone, though his words make her feel even more overheated. "It is unfair," she admits. "I have a feeling if I were to undress, you might notice."
"I'm sorry to admit it, but I definitely would."
If there was any doubt before, Isby is fairly certain now that the prince is flirting with her. They are, in fact, flirting with each other. This has been happening more and more recently. Their conversations will stray from political strategy to philosophical musings to quick-fire banter without her realizing how they got there. "Anyway," she says now, "it doesn't matter. It's women who are taught to be modest, not men. You can do pretty much whatever you want without impunity."
"Now that I disagree with," William responded.
"Really? Imagine my surprise. You never disagree with me," she says. "But do tell, for what action would you, as a man, risk censure?"
"For one thing, I can't play the harpsichord in public. I would definitely receive censure for that."
She laughs. Sometimes it startles her the way William makes her laugh, even though they are on a potentially deadly mission. She shouldn't be happy, she tells herself. Not when her sister may not survive the sickness. Not when their country is being invaded by the forces of an evil fairy queen. Not when she is stuck in a morbidly hot chamber with a distractingly interesting prince who does not belong to her and never can and never will. Then again, she's heard peasants laugh openly and freely even during the cold of winter, when their bones practically protrude from their thin shifts. She's heard a dying orphan squeal with secret glee. Happiness is funny like that. It's not bound to circumstance. She adjusts her dress, feeling how it clings to her, wishing she could just rip it off her body like she might have done when she was a child playing in the stream with Gilbert. Gilbert. There's another source of painful confusion. How can she feel what she's feeling now in the presence of William and still know in her heart that she has never cared for any boy the way she cares for Gil? It's possible she may never know for sure whether he survived, may live in half mourning until the day she dies. The playfulness evaporates from her heart, replaced with a tightness. Guilt for joking about a harpsichord, let alone with Prince William, the man she is bringing home for her sister to marry. She fidgets, the heat starting to go to her head. It's definitely hot in here. But she and William have become accustomed to hiding out in unusual places over the last week, ever since their rescue by sisters Genevieve and Catherine. The two nuns had left them at a crossroads that night, just before dawn, with explicit directions to the first stop on the veiled road, though Sister Genevieve warned that if they didn't arrive before sunup, they'd be as good as dead. Malfleur's mercenaries in Islay would by then have redoubled their efforts to locate Isby and William, who wouldn't stand a chance on their own in broad daylight. And so for nearly a week they've been travelling like this, under the cover of night, from house to house along the veiled road, ushered in by servants who increasingly seem to have heard about them and their plans. Despite the fact that they previously understood the alliance to be deeply unpleasant to most of the serfdom, it turns out that the story of the bastard princess of Deleuze and the third prince of Arbin has reached and inspired many throughout the land. Many people no longer see Malfleur as a trumped-up threat invented by the council, but a real looming danger
thanks to her gruesome mercenaries raiding so many villages along the western and southern borders, threatening serfs and killing nobles. And while the sleeping council is still out of favor among the masses, it seems many of the serving class are willing to look on an alliance with renewed optimism. It's incredible, really, how terror can change the tides of a kingdom. Which is how Isby and William have come to find themselves in yet another secret chamber within the estate of a very rich noblewoman, and a fairy at that. They were surprised at first to learn that Almondine's home was a stop on the Veiled Road. They had, perhaps naively, assumed that much of the fairy population supported Malfleur, if for no other reason than the fact that they feared her retaliation if they didn't. Then again, Almondine herself might simply have no knowledge that her servants are part of the anti-Lamort resistance. Beads of sweat drip down Isby's back. "In all seriousness, Isabel," William says quietly. He seems to have noticed her mood darkening. "I may have many privileges as a royal and as a male, but I am not free to do whatever I would wish. I am not free, for example, to choose whom I marry, or to marry for love."
The silence after his words is heavy. "I'm not sure what you mean," Isby finally responds. "You agreed to come with me. You agreed to marry Aurora for the Alliance. That was absolutely your choice, and..." She takes a breath, finding herself sick to her stomach to have to repeat this once again. "You will fall in love with her when you see her. And then the two of them will have the true love that is destined to undo the curse. This is the wild hope, like a hand in the dark, to which Isby has been clinging ever since she and Gilbert left Binx's study, which seems like it occurred in a former lifetime but was actually less than a fortnight ago." William hesitates before responding. Isby realizes that every time he pauses, every time he takes a breath, she unconsciously holds hers in, waiting. And when his words come, they rush to her, convincing and taut as a harpoon's line, their points snagging her in the heart and pulling and pulling.
"Tell me something else about her,"
William says. Isby leans against the wall, its cool, damp marble providing small relief to the overwhelming heat. She can't help it. She doesn't want to talk about Aurora, not in this moment, not when she can feel the intensity of the prince's gaze on her skin, not when the steam is wrapping itself around her senses, making her emotions slick and difficult to hold in, like if she lets her guard down for even a second, some secret truth may slip out that she'll forever regret. And yet the details pour out of her, because some parts of us never change. Some facts are inalterable. You cannot crack open Isby's heart without releasing the purest form of love she knows. Her love for her sister. She tells him about her favorite childhood memories, their secret language, the hidden passageway connecting their bedrooms, the snow sculptures and the games of make-believe, the stories they told each other, the tricks they played on the stuffiest of council members. She even tells him some of the darker memories, how Queen Amelie used to scorn Isby, sometimes refused to let her sit at the dinner table with the rest of the royal family, slapped her hands and face when she disobeyed her nurses, and found elaborate, almost hilarious ways to place blame on her for absolutely everything, from the grand hall getting too draughty in winter to the beets being stewed too long, to King Henri withholding his affection from her, because, the queen argued, Isabel reminded him of his former love, an absurd claim when everyone knew he had countless flings, all meaningless and disposable, prior to marrying the queen. And how, amid all this, Aurora would sneak Isby treats from the kitchen when she was sent to bed without supper, or bring thick, feather-stuffed blankets from her room when the frigid air coming off the strait snuck under the doorframe and chilled her bones. Though she couldn't stand up for Isby by speaking, Aurora found countless ways, big and small, to remind Isby that she did matter. Whatever happened, however hard things got, Isby always knew that Aurora was there for her. Isby doesn't notice the wetness at the corner of her eyes until she feels the heat of the sauna increase as William leans closer, his fingers grazing her cheek, wiping a tear away. "Isabel," he says softly. And just as quickly, she is shot forward from the past into the now,
The memories burn off, and she can only think of how close the prince is, how steady and calm his voice is, how his fingers dance across her skin. Not at all in the awkward, mechanical way he claims to play the harpsichord, but freely, as though he's reading her expression the way she has read Gilbert's and Aurora's for years. He has moved to sit beside her on the same bench, and she's uncomfortably aware of the fact that he is bare-chested. This man who teases her, but also takes her so seriously. This man who calls her by her full name. This man who somehow blots out all reason, who makes her almost forget all of the impossible walls between them. Aurora, Gilbert, status and rank, and her formerly stalwart loathing for all things romantic, not to mention the fate of both their kingdoms. This prince, who is not hers to fall for. Yes, she says, to fill the space between them. She realizes now why she is always in such suspense when he speaks. It's because he never finished saying what he wanted to tell her back when they were captured by Malfleur's soldiers and thrown into the carriage bound for La Morte. In the days that have passed since, he hasn't brought it up. What if there's another way to establish the alliance? He asks hoarsely.
Another way?
Please. He puts his hand on her shoulder. Don't pretend to misunderstand me.
Pretend? I'm sorry. What?
Your sister may or may not awaken.
She doesn't like his tone, so weighty all of a sudden.
The air around her feels thick. It's hard to breathe.
She will. We have to try.
There are no guarantees. She may not wake up.
Stop saying that. You don't think I know that?
The heat of the tiny room envelops her, rising up from within to choke her.
Giving up on Aurora is not an option. Not for me.
Her throat is so tight, she's not sure if she can continue speaking. I'm not saying I want to give up. He lets go of her shoulder.
Then what are you saying?
I want the alliance, like you do. We have agreed it's mutually beneficial.
Mutually beneficial?
Why does the phrase sting so much? The words ring cold in her ears like a piece of silverware that has clattered to the floor. She swallows back her discomfort.
Yes, we have agreed.
Emphasis on agreed. He doesn't seem like someone who would go back on his word, which is why she's finding this turn in the conversation so perplexing. Well, this journey has allowed me to do some thinking since then.
No, if he backs out now, she's not sure what she'll do. She'll scream, she'll explode. She'll find the closest poniard and rip open his throat.
Well, maybe not that, but she certainly wouldn't be afraid to point its blade meaningfully at his neck.
He clears his throat.
And I realize that I no longer want to marry Aurora.
You don't? You don't want to marry my sister? But that's the whole point. How else can we undo the curse? How else do we convince the kingdoms? How else do we send a powerful enough message to Malfleur?
I'm not trying to talk politics.
What?
Now he really has her confused, and she's beginning to think the sauna steam has melted her mind into little more than a puddle. Isabel, he says, exasperated. He grabs her hand. My marital interests lie elsewhere now. Have you not considered it?
Has she not considered it? Considered it? Considered what?
She feels nauseated. Let me rephrase that, he adds quickly. Will you consider it?
Will I consider
being my wife?
She chokes and leans forward, coughing. Her eyes water. She must have inhaled saliva.
She must have also lost her hearing. She coughs again, and the coughing turns into a delirious sound that can only be described as deranged laughter. You think I'm joking?
No, I... She breathes. I got confused. I thought you were...
Proposing to you. I was. Trying to, at least.
What? She blurts out, cheeks burning. If that's your idea of a proposal, then you just stick to playing the harpsichord.
She clears her throat, immediately regretting her reaction. I'm serious. I take it, however, that you are not interested.
Not interested? She shakes her head, unable to process the wild mix of emotions. She's elated and shocked and terrified, confused and mortified and overwhelmed. All she can do is focus on his words. What I'm interested in,
she says slowly, trying to make him understand, trying to make herself understand.
What I'm interested in doesn't matter.
Why does she feel so choked up? It's the truth, anyway. The firmest thing she can hang on to. This journey isn't about her. It's about the kingdom, about her sister, about William, even. But not about her.
Is that a no?
His voice has gotten quieter, his grip on her hands less certain. Now he lets them go, and she feels something inside her, something carefully constructed, beginning to splinter. It's a struggle to speak. The word no seems so heavy, so final. She shakes her head.
You're marrying my sister.
William slides away from her on the bench.
I see.
Isby wants to cry. Or maybe to scream.
Apparently you don't.
How can she explain why his idea is so impossible? It just is. Aurora is the one to be wed. Aurora is the beautiful one, the crown princess, whose title matters, who matters, period. Prince William choosing Isby would be laughable. No one would take it seriously. Isby lives on the sidelines. Isby stays in the shadows. Isby is the shadow. Aurora is the light. These facts are as natural to her as the knowledge that the sun rises in the morning and sinks at night. Some things just are the way they are. It may not be fair, but she has learned to accept it, learned to live with it, learned not to want things she can't have, because wanting those things hurts too much.
I'm sorry, really. I didn't mean to upset you, he says.
Well, you have,
she responds, the hurt and the fear of that hurt curling into a tight ball in her throat.
I really wish you hadn't said such a foolish thing. It wasn't thoughtful of you at all.
It didn't occur to me that you'd be angry, he answers roughly.
It didn't occur to her either. But she is angry. He knows so little about her, truly. He knows nothing of Gilbert, who might be dead. Gil, the person to whom she always believed she would give her heart if she were ever to give it away. And did William even consider what it must feel like for her to have to decline a proposal from a prince? A prince whose unexpected brashness thrills her. A prince whose bravery and steadiness have, in a very short time, become an intrinsic part of her own. A prince who is clumsy with musical instruments, but swift with a weapon and full of grace when he touches marble, moulding it into beauty, and too, when he touches her. A prince who freely uses big words like variegated and susurrus. A prince who is willing to think differently than his brothers, than his countrymen, than anyone else she knows. Maybe if Isby were the crown princess, or if William were not the last heir of Arben, or if Aurora weren't in trouble. But none of those things are true. She opens her mouth to remind him so, when instead the door of the sauna is thrown open and a burst of cold air shocks her into silence.
Not to fear, it's me, Annette,
says the woman who must be the head housemaid of the estate. She speaks elegantly without the accent of many of the peasants Isby and William have encountered on their journey.
You can come this way, and please do hurry.
William couldn't have stood up any faster even if his breeches had caught fire. He throws his doublet back on with a hasty thwack.
"'We're
ever
so flattered to be of service to you both,'
Annette says, leading them through an elaborate maze of servants' quarters, "'and grateful for your efforts during these difficult times.' As they move through Lady Almondine's estate, Annette explains that the household servants are all taught in the arts of massage and that their primary duties involve maintaining the various salt and clear water baths of differing temperatures. According to Annette, there is an entire room full of twigs dedicated to whipping the blood into a frenzy.' Lady Almondine apparently also has many personal trainers who keep her well practiced in the arts of riding and fencing and dancing. And then, there are the lovers. Isby blushes as Annette lowers her voice, continuing to gossip about her ladyship.
Lady gets all kinds of private visitors, she says. Big, small, tall, short, men, women, and some whose sex I couldn't tell you if I tried.
That's why there are so many sneaking halls throughout the house. Many ways for her friends to arrive and depart discreetly. It's also why we've become one of the most important junctures on the Veiled Road, she explains with pride.
Ah, Isby says,
though the last thing she wants to hear about at the moment is the intimate life of a deranged fairy, when all she can think of is William and his proposal. He is deathly silent during their tour through the underbelly of the estate. Though Lady Almondine hasn't taken any visitors at all in the last week, Annette goes on, her chatter becoming white noise in Isby's ears. Acting strange lately, she has. Not herself, that's for sure. Only some of the words reach Isby. What she's really listening to is William's silence. No pleasure in it, Annette is saying. None at all. Changed. That's certain. Isby can only assume William resents her now, maybe even hates her. Men, she knows, cannot stand to have their egos stomped on. But he had to be let down. He was the one in the wrong. He never should have said what he did. She can only hope the steam had gone to his head, like it had to hers, and that he'll come to his senses and apologize. Then they can attempt to bridge the deep rift of awkwardness that has now come between them. But given his hard, angry stomps on the marble staircase as they make their way to the safe guest quarters, she's not sure that day will come very soon. Annette keeps talking, oblivious to the tension between her two charges. Not sure her visit to the Fairy Queen Malfleur, she whispers. I'm sorry, what about Malfleur? Isby asks, finally tuning in to the housemaid's voice. Oh, just speculation, of course. The lady went out to see her cousin in La Morte almost a week ago for a so-called hunting trip, and we don't know if she's pledged her support for the evil queen or not. To tell the truth, none of us can get a sense of what really happened during that visit, only that something has very much changed in the lady's demeanour since her return, and she won't stop muttering about long-beaked birds, vultures. Disconcerting, Isby agrees. Does this mean Almondine is pro-Malfleur? When they arrived here this morning, Isby was full of hope. Maybe Almondine could even help them, she thought. If she was present at Aurora's christening, it is possible she knows something about the curse and how it works. Now it's clear that it would be far too dangerous to risk discovery. Annette goes on to tell a horrifying story about one of their horses, who bolted a month ago only to be found days later on the side of the road, gutted by another animal, something with claws and fangs. Definitely wasn't wolves, Annette says. Possibly some sort of mountain lion or wild cat. They couldn't be sure. Meanwhile, Isby goes back to focusing on the prince and his stubborn shroud of silence. She tries to remind herself that it doesn't work. He can hate her now, as long as he sees through his commitments to her. As long as he falls in love with her sister, kisses Aurora awake, and seals the alliance between their kingdoms. Nothing else is important. Not their friendship, if that's what they'd had up until a few moments ago. And certainly of least importance is the way her chest feels like it's been cleaved in two by a warhammer. Annette finally stows them away in a clean room that smells of salt and roses. Winter sunlight penetrates the room through warbled crown glass, warming her face. There is, however, only one bed. Rather than discuss the issue, William, as he had often done these past few days, settles onto the floor. She hears the clinking buckles of his belt and boots as he tries to get comfortable, still not saying anything. She climbs wordlessly into the bed, pulling the sheets up around her damp dress. All the heat from the sauna has fled from her body and left her feeling shivery and exhausted. She's surprised a little while later, and a bit disappointed, to hear William's faint breathing on the floor beside the bed. He has fallen asleep. She can't fathom how that's possible. He has robbed her of that ability. The more she lies there trying to sleep, the more awake and restless and angry she becomes. They are within riding distance of the Delusian Palace at this point. The only two things stopping them from continuing the rest of their journey today are one, the fact that it's still daylight and therefore dangerous, and two, they still aren't sure how they are going to protect themselves against the sleeping sickness. They don't know how contagious it really is, nor, more importantly, how it passes from one person to another. Up until now, Isby's goal has been theoretical at best, but it's about to become all too real. Either they will make it to Aurora and succeed in waking her, or they will fail. Within a day or two at most, she'll have her answer. Her still wet clothes cling to her, the fabric crawling over her skin like a thousand tiny ants. She tries to swallow, but her throat is parched. She can't sleep, doesn't want to. She'll have plenty of time to sleep later, she thinks morbidly, if the sickness gets to her. What does it feel like, she wonders, to be trapped deep in the illness that is ravaging their country? She's got to get William to her sister. She's suddenly intensely consumed with the urgency of it. She needs to see Aurora. She needs to save her. What has she been doing, spying on nuns and freeing a narwhal, traipsing through the countryside and flirting with a prince? She's no longer angry at William. She's angry at herself. If she had just stayed the course, everything might have been different. She has to make things right. Isby throws back the covers. The sauna must have dehydrated her. She can't think. She needs water badly. She stumbles out into the hallway, which is cold and echoey. She wraps her arms around herself and tries to remember which way they came. She's pretty sure Annette pointed out where the kitchens are, but the layout of the house is unlike any other she's been to. She turns left, then takes another left. Then after about 40 paces, she feels around for the staircase she could swear was at the end of the next corridor. She's not sure which wrong turn she has taken until it's too late. She stumbles into a vast, bright room rich with moisture and minerals. She hears a tinkling sound, like a gentle flowing spring. This must be one of Almandine's bathing chambers. She's about to back out, but then it occurs to her that perhaps the fountain is potable. Maybe she could just take a quick sip before finding her way back. She takes a few steps toward the plashing fountain, and hears a gasp. Isby freezes in place, with no idea whether the other person in the room has spotted her. There's another gasp, and then the sound of a woman moaning. Isby's ears blaze in alarm. Oh, no. Has she walked in on Lady Almandine with one of her paramours? Isby feels dizzy with humiliation and disgust. She has to get out of here somehow. Carefully, she takes one step backward, extending her hands to make sure she doesn't bump into anything and make a noise. Almandine releases another moan, except it's not exactly a moan, and certainly not one of pleasure. It's more like a groan, and a little bit like a quiet sob. As Isby stands there trying to figure out how to make an exit without drawing notice, it becomes obvious that these are sounds of anguish. Isby doesn't know what to do. She would just bolt, but something keeps her rooted to the spot. She has never been at ease with people crying, and truth be told, it never occurred to her that the Fae could cry. Maybe it isn't the lady of the house after all. It might only be a troubled servant. "Pardon me," Isby finds herself saying. "Can I... is there something I can do?" Water swishing. The person is in one of the baths. She can't imagine the household staff freely availing themselves of the mistress's baths. Isby swallows hard. So then it must be Lady Almandine. The woman sucks in a breath.
"Belka,"
she asks abruptly, her voice ragged and shaky.
"How?"
Almandine's tone changes, hardens.
"Your face."
"No."
"Who are you?"
she demands.
"Madam, I apologize. I just..." "Have you come to help me out of my path? Here, then. Fetch my robe,"
she commands in a husky whisper. Isby should really run out of the room, but part of her is riveted, tingling with curiosity. Besides, fleeing would make her seem suspicious. If the lady has mistaken Isby for a servant, that's far preferable to her discovering the truth.
"Your robe, but don't be stupid. The robe, on the back of the Adonis. I... where..."
Isby fumbles, trying to figure out how to explain. Lady Almandine has clearly not noticed what some find obvious, the blankness of Isby's eyes, the way they seem to wander, unseeing. She starts to walk to her right, and the fairy huffs.
"That's Apollo, the one under the west window."
Ah, that helps at least. Isby moves in the opposite direction, toward the hottest, brightest part of the room, where she can sense the sun has moved past its highest point in the sky. She bangs her shins on what seems to be a large marble vase out of which a small tree sprouts, then feels around, knocking into several more plants and trees until she finds a rather large sculpture that resembles a Greek god, one arm extended, on which hangs a thick, knit silk robe. She grabs it and hurries in the direction of Almandine's voice. The lady has been muttering to herself, her voice like leather on leather. Now, as Isby approaches her cautiously, she makes out some of the words the fairy is saying.
"Daisy is as Daisy does. Always was. Always was," she tisks to herself. "I should have known." She always was.
I'm sorry? Isby asks as she approaches the vast marble pool in which the fairy has been bathing. No steam rises to greet Isby's hands, and she realizes the water is cold. And it's the dead of winter. The woman must be freezing.
I said I should have known!